You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to episode 26. I hope you enjoyed the last show, which was all about A Girl's Guide to New Orleans. In fact, I interviewed the co-founders and owners of that brand, Kelly and Mignon. We had a great time talking at the Catahoula Hotel and the rooftop bar in the Central Business District. And Kelly and Mignon offered lots of great ideas for the female traveler. We talked about what to pack and how to plan. We talked about things to do while you were here. And we talked about some things that maybe are a little bit more focused on the female traveler, things like shopping and where to get your hair done if you need to, that sort of thing. But guys, don't despair. There was an awful lot of information there that was terrific no matter who you are. If you missed it, though, go back and check it out. Before we jump into today's show, I want to tell you about something I've started doing. Based on a lot of requests I was getting, I started offering a service where I'll provide a customized list of where to stay, what to do, eat, and see in your next visit to New Orleans. It includes a 20-minute discussion with me to get a sense of your preferences, when you're going to visit, price points, that sort of thing. If you're interested, send me an email over at mark@beyondbourbonst.com. Before we get into today's topic, I want to say thanks to those of you who left me a review on iTunes. We're up to 97 five-star reviews now. Thanks to Western Michigan Nola, who writes, "My wife and I have listened to the podcast for 6 months in advance of our next trip to New Orleans. Each time we listen, we learn something new, and it deepens our appreciation for the culture and history of a city we've visited many times. We'll be in the French Quarter for the Halloween parade," so they were in the past, or this review is in the past, "but we'll be spending most of our time in Uptown, Carrollton, and City Park, thanks to insights from the podcast. Keep up the good work." Well, thanks, y'all. Drop me a line and let me know where you ended up on your visit. Thanks also to Marky, who writes, "My name is Marco, and I'm a big fan of Nola and a podcast freak." Well, I like both those a lot too, Marco. He goes on to say the segment of preparing for Mardi Gras was super informative and funny. "I'd love to hear a future show on the local arts scene, or maybe a spooky show sometime. Peace and good vibes." Well, same to you, Marco. I'll add those ideas to the list. I really appreciate all of you take the time to leave a review on iTunes. It gives me great feedback, and it helps grow the show by telling people who are looking for podcasts about New Orleans that this is a good one. If you do leave me a review, I'll mention you on an upcoming episode, just like I did with Western Michigan and Marky. Now, on to today's topic. Today's episode is all about the HBO series Tremé. I had multiple requests from listeners to do a show about the HBO series, but I let it simmer for several months because I wasn't really sure how to approach it. I knew I couldn't do a breakdown of every episode, and I didn't really want to. It would be exhausting mentally and emotionally. Instead, I wanted to think about it from a larger perspective, but I needed a way to make it manageable and engaging. After a while, I realized that the reason you listen to Beyond Bourbon Street is that you get to explore New Orleans along with me, someone who lives here. Someone who knows the city and can show you a perspective you won't get from a large publication or a big website. So that's the approach I'm taking on today's topic. And here's what I've come up with. We'll discuss what the series is about and what the show creators were trying to accomplish. We'll cover the authenticity. Do I think it's an accurate portrayal of the city and life after the storm? We'll talk about the people who are represented and the characters in the show. We'll talk about what Tremé as a series meant to the people of New Orleans, including my take. And along the way, I'll highlight some of the insider things about the show. And I'll share a few ways you can experience the sights, the sounds, the tastes of what you see in Tremé. With that, let's jump in. In a nutshell, Tremé is an HBO series that was on television for a total of 4 seasons or 36 episodes. It was created by David Simon and Eric Overmyer. Among other things, you probably know them for their earlier series on HBO, The Wire. They also worked together on Homicide, Life on the Street. Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and the Gulf Coast on August 29, 2005. Tremé is set in New Orleans 3 months after the storm, and it traces the lives of New Orleanians trying to rebuild their lives, their cultures, and their city. Tremé actually made its debut on April 11, 2010, 4.5 years after the storm, and the last episode aired on December 29, 2013. And I should jump in and say, as we're getting going, just a little bit of a disclaimer. Those of you that have listened for a while know my story. I grew up here in New Orleans, born and raised. My family was here at the time of the storm. My parents were. But my wife and I were living in Washington, D.C., or just outside Washington, D.C. at the time. So I owned a house here that had 4 feet of water, and the roof was destroyed. But my parents lost their home. They had water into the attic. And we lost our restaurant. So basically, the two levees broke on the same canal. One on one side, my family home backed up against the levee. So our backyard then touched the levee canal behind it. It broke. The same canal, a levee broke on the other side and flooded our restaurant, which was about 1.5 miles away. So my experience, while my family was affected, I want to be real clear that I wasn't here during the storm. And for people that are listening that were here, you know, I have no way to put myself in your shoes, nor would I try to. I do think it was such a shared experience because if you're from New Orleans and you have family here, whether you were living here or not, everyone you knew was affected. Sometimes gravely, there were people we knew who lost their lives, but everyone was affected. Most people, you couldn't talk to someone without knowing somebody who lost everything they owned. So I only say that to say, I know a lot about the city. I grew up here. I was back and forth quite a bit then, but I in no way want to sort of put myself in the shoes of the people that were here when the storm actually hit or in the immediate aftermath. We came back with my parents to bring them back when the first time we could, which was in October, about 6-7 weeks after the storm. So with that disclaimer, let's get into the show a little bit. The name of the series comes from one of the oldest neighborhoods in New Orleans, the Tremé. The Tremé is also the oldest African-American neighborhood in the United States. It's located just across Rampart Street from the French Quarter. And sometimes you'll hear locals refer to the Tremé as back of town, or back of town, as in back of the original footprint in New Orleans. So why did Simon and Overmeyer focus the show on the Tremé neighborhood? Well, for one thing, it's the center of Creole culture, as you heard Vance Fokerson talk about so eloquently on episode 20 of this show. Additionally, much of New Orleans' culture and traditions, struggles and triumphs can be traced right into this neighborhood, and specifically to Congo Square. We've talked about Congo Square in the past, but if you're not familiar with it, it was the meeting place for slaves in New Orleans, a place where they could drum the rhythms they brought with them aboard the slave ships, and a place where they could buy and sell goods and have a measure of community, obviously under horrible conditions, but at least they had some measure of community. In an interview with NPR about the Tremé series just before its release, local musician Kermit Ruffins described Congo Square as the heartbeat of America. He went on to say, "Because this is where our only true art form was invented, jazz. Took those European instruments and mixed it with the African culture, and there it was, jazz." About Katrina, he added, "Crazy. The storm brought a lot of good and a lot of bad. It took the mask off everything. Everybody could see what the city was for, and who was running it. The corruption and the good. The reefer-smoking musicians are so good, the politicians are so bad. They were telling us we were bad." Ruffin's hope was that Tremé would show the rest of the country what the truth really is. Simon and Overmeyer consulted with many New Orleanians in conceptualizing the series, and also while it was being written and created. Central among them was Tom Piazza, author of the nonfiction book Why New Orleans Matters. Piazza and Overmeyer had known one another for years. Eric Overmeyer is a part-time resident of New Orleans, and Simon had read and enjoyed Piazza's work. They also hired Times-Picayune reporter Lawless Eric Ellie. Simon himself had been a reporter before working in television and was impressed with Ellie's expansive knowledge of local people and background. Ellie was a writer of the documentary Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. These two writers, along with Kermit Ruffins and Donald Harrison Jr., helped shape the narrative in the minds of Simon and Overmeyer and ultimately led them to the Tremé as the focal point of the series they were trying to create. In an interview with a website called The Futon Critic, Eric Overmeyer says, "New Orleans is a city which lives in the imagination of the whole world. We wanted to capture something authentic about it, as its people struggle with the effects of the greatest calamity to befall an American city in the history of this country." Simon echoed the sentiment in an interview with NPR where he talked about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. He's also written and spoken about his belief that mini Katrinas happen every day all across America. People are confronted with tragedy. They get knocked down and they have to get back up. The world focuses on the immediate story, but the victim has to deal with not only the immediate tragedy, but also their life and circumstances as they were before, and then the reality afterwards. These two statements from the co-producers and the co-creators of the show really get to the heart of the series. The story is and was about everyday people from different walks of life trying to rebuild. All this is set against the New Orleans that existed before the storm and the reactions after it, both locally, but maybe more importantly, nationally. And some context here. New Orleans, as you know, is a wonderful place, but it's not an easy place to live. It wasn't before the storm, it isn't now, and it certainly wasn't in the months and years just after Katrina. You had political corruption, a crumbling infrastructure. You had racial and socioeconomic tensions. You had problems with the police department, the school system. But all in all, it may be messed up, but it's still our messed up part of these United States. And you know, while I was preparing to do this episode, I read a lot of interviews. I think Simon's viewpoint was to show that what happened after Katrina, but again as a backdrop, and to show that this can and does happen all over the United States. You know, and when it does, you got ordinary people, they're trying to live ordinary lives, and they have to confront all these things, the immediate problems of whatever it is, whether it's a mass shooting, or it's a flood, or as I'm recording this, a fire in Oakland just the other day. And then you have the outside perceptions of the event, right, and the community. Did the community do enough, and what was the situation, and who's to blame, and how do you fix it? And then you also got to deal with the reality that was there in that community before the major event. Like I mentioned, I love my home, I love New Orleans, but there were problems here before the storm. In many ways, the storm brought some new problems, gave some opportunities for people, but at the same time, while people were trying to clean up and move on with their lives, they also had to deal with all the things that had happened before and all the problems that were present before. And as I read so much and looked into it, that's the whole message, I think, that particularly Simon was trying to get at. That he saw New Orleans as this beautiful canvas, and this tragedy happened, and they wanted to talk about New Orleanians and New Orleans and the recovery and the rebuilding and the struggle, but on a bigger picture, they also wanted to represent in the characters that this could happen and it does happen anywhere. And hey, a quick note: this is an HBO series, and as is typical of HBO series, the language might be a bit offensive if you don't like cursing. It's nowhere near The Wire, but it's definitely there. You'll also come across the occasional brief nudity, so you've been warned. Let's get into the actual show. As I mentioned, New Orleans is an incredibly vibrant canvas, but the themes presented in Treme are probably relatable no matter where you live. And the characters bring this to life, as you'll hear about. Here's a little tidbit, too. The initial episode of the series is titled, Do You Know What It Means? And the very last episode of the series closes the loop and is titled, To Miss New Orleans. So you get the Do You Know What It Means to start and the To Miss New Orleans to close the whole thing out 4 years later. The first thing you see in the very first show is a black background with the words New Orleans, Louisiana, then 3 months after. The show opens with a traditional second line, and you also see National Guardsmen in the background and officers from the New Orleans Police Department. At that time, it seemed like for months the National Guard patrolled the city. And you could hear helicopters at night when we would come back to work on the properties that we own. You'd hear the helicopters, you'd see the guardsmen come by. And they're definitely trying to focus on that in this very opening scene to show, well, they're trying to have the second line, this sort of quasi-military presence, right, occupying almost the city. All this hints at the way Overmyer and Simon present the whole series and also provide some of the charm to a local. And I'm talking about the second line here. There's lots of material in the show that kind of gives you two views. One is a surface-level accounting of life in New Orleans that's largely accurate and a feast in terms of visually and musically. But if you know what to look for, you also get a lot of acknowledgement of insider-type things, the same thing they did on The Wire for the people in Baltimore. Let's just look at these first couple minutes of the very first episode. So you see a second line. And a New Orleans second line is derived from the traditions associated with our jazz funerals. In this case, the second line that opens the premiere of Treme is meant to recreate a second line that was actually staged on October 9th, 2005. It was held in honor of Austin Leslie. And actually, you can see a photo of Leslie. Very briefly, it's on a sign being waved around at about the 5-minute, 30-second mark in the first episode. Austin Leslie was internationally known. He was a Creole chef from the 7th Ward in the heart of the Treme. He was also the inspiration for the late 1980s TV show Frank's Place. Chef Leslie met Jacques Leonardi, the owner of Giacomo's in the mid-90s, and agreed to come to the new restaurant and take care of the fried chicken. He stayed at Giacomo's until 2004 before returning to the 7th Ward at a place called Pampy's Creole Kitchen, which is well known for its fried chicken and Creole food. Chef Leslie was one of many people in New Orleans that was trapped in his attic after Hurricane Katrina. He was rescued after 2 days and evacuated to Atlanta, where he died in September 2005. He was honored with the first jazz funeral held in New Orleans after the storm. And again, it's that second line that's portrayed in these first scenes of Treme. It really captures the essence, too, and the flavor of a second line. You have the music, always a brass band in a second line. You got the community out, and you can see in those opening scenes, they're amid the ruins of their neighborhood. Second lines are almost always held in largely African-American communities, but you see people of all races coming together. There's lots of dancing. You'll see in Treme and also in general, you'll see the dancing and the kind of stepping, always wearing big, bright costumes, bright outfits. You'll see people jumping in. There's also, in this first scene, you can see, I think, a young kid selling beer and snacks from Ice Chest. And that's not an uncommon scene as you're taking part or observing a second line. It really gets, again, at the importance of community and our traditions here and how even just a couple, 6 weeks or so right after the storm, that the community came together in the middle of all this to honor Austin Leslie and to honor traditions. The point that they make, too, with the focusing in on the National Guard and the police, it gets to the fact that there's been a long-running tension between second-line organizations as well as Mardi Gras Indian gangs and the local police. Providing those close-up shots there is definitely intentional, and it alludes to the plot lines that carry through the series. Another thing is you can instantly see the use of local musicians and actors, and that's a hallmark of the series and something certainly that Simon and Overmeyer have done in the past, particularly in The Wire. You instantly see the use of local musicians and actors. That's a hallmark of the series. It's also something that Simon and Overmeyer did with their previous series, The Wire, about Baltimore. They used a lot of local actors in that one. So here, right from the start, you see the guy that's negotiating how much the band's going to be paid is Keith Frazier. He plays drums in the parade. You can also spot Glenn David Andrews, who's a trombone player. The band there is Rebirth. So Rebirth is a really well-known, you've heard me talk about it, and you're probably familiar with Rebirth Brass Band. So they're in the show right from the start. They talk about Trombone Shorty, who doesn't make an appearance in the opening scenes, but you certainly see throughout the show. And also, I should mention Kermit Ruffins, who was not only a collaborator and a consultant on the show, you'll see him in many of the episodes throughout the 4 years. But he was also one of the original members and founders of Rebirth. We get to meet our first recurring character in these opening minutes too, Antoine Baptiste, who's played by New Orleans actor Wendell Pierce. He's the trombone player who hops out of the taxi and runs to catch up with the band. As I mentioned, local music is featured throughout the series, and it's one of the things that everybody enjoyed about it. Right away, we come up on the Rebirth hit, Feel Like Funkin' It Up. Not only does music play an important part in the story throughout the series, but it shows up in subtle ways too. For instance, every one of the 36 episodes has a title, and most of those are named after New Orleans songs, or at least songs recorded or written by New Orleans artists. In any event, let's talk about Antoine Baptiste for a minute. As I mentioned, Wendell Pierce plays the character Antoine. Antoine's a trombone player who bounces from gig to gig, he cheats taxi drivers, and he lives with the mother of his youngest child. He has no car since the storm, so he's always late, and he rarely makes it to Baton Rouge to see his two oldest kids. During the series, he ends up taking a job eventually as a music teacher to supplement his pay as a musician. And he's prone to vice, specifically drinks, the ladies, cards, perhaps even, I know it's hard to believe, the occasional hit of marijuana. Antoine's character, is not really one person. Though I've read a lot of things that say Kermit Ruffin certainly came to mind. And Kermit is certainly his own soul, but he plays a prominent and recurring role in the series as himself. Regardless, Antoine's definitely a common figure in New Orleans music circles. The struggles he faces after Katrina were all too common. Being displaced, losing his home, likely no insurance, no permanent source of income. I know at least one other New Orleans musician specifically who had to do exactly what Antoine does in Tremé, that is, get a real job. And I read a great interview with Wendell Pierce at NPR. I'll post a link to that interview or the transcript of the interview over in the show notes, which will be at beyondbourbonst.com/26. Near the end of this opening scene, the second line ends in front of a bar. The bar is owned by Antoine's ex-wife and the mother of his two oldest children. Condi Alexander portrays LaDonna Baptiste Williams. She's Antoine's ex-wife, but she's now married to a dentist. After the storm, she splits her time between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, where her family relocated. In New Orleans, she owns a neighborhood bar. She takes care of her elderly mother, and she's searching for her younger brother, Damo, who was arrested and went missing during the storm. While the second line's going on, we also meet Davis and Jeanette. One of the more amusing and sometimes aggravating characters is Davis McElhary, played by Steve Zahn. McElhary is the fictionalized version of New Orleanian Davis Rogan. On screen, Davis is a DJ, a WWOZ, and a musician. In real life, Davis Rogan is a talented musician and a writer. He was a consultant on the show. He made several appearances in episodes. He even co-wrote a script for an episode, and he was the piano coach. Throughout the series, Davis frequently goes off on long, sometimes frustrating diatribes. Davis McElhary, that is. Buried in there, though, are often some good primers and context, particularly on matters of New Orleans music. In the first season, it's Davis that clues you in to the fact that Elvis Costello is sitting in the bar taking in a Kermit Ruffin's performance. And a side note here, in that scene, Davis McElhary actually acknowledges the real-life Davis Rogan. In fact, on more than one occasion throughout the series, the character of Davis interacts with the real-life Davis. Lots of viewers won't notice because they won't know who Davis Rogan is, probably. But the ones who do, like me, are as amused as I'm sure Simon and Overmeyer intended. And that's the thing, there's lots of these sort of Easter eggs, these little gifts, throughout the 36 episodes. And even as I was preparing for this show and went back and watched a bunch of episodes, I saw a handful that I had never realized before the first time I saw it. As Davis joins in the followers of the second line, you can see the bell tower of St. Augustine Church in the background. St. Augustine is the oldest African-American Catholic parish in the United States, and it's on the same street, right down the street, like half a block from the Backstreet Cultural Museum, which you've heard me talk about before. Congress Square is nearby, like a baseball's throw away. And they end the second line, on the way to the bar, they pass the Claiborne Overpass, which Claiborne Avenue was sort of the center of African-American culture in New Orleans in the 1950s and 60s. And they built an overpass, which effectively just sort of destroyed the commerce there, because all of a sudden you had this Live Oak Line Boulevard. Then they bulldozed all that and put this big concrete overpass there, or interstate stretch there. And most of the businesses died off or changed, and it really, really changed the neighborhood. So it's not insignificant that they would end, or at least pass through on the second line there. Interestingly enough, if you go under the overpass there today, the columns that support the interstate structure, many of them are painted and done up with murals recognizing some of the notable figures from the Tremé, particularly musicians. At any rate, not only do they go to the overpass, Rebirth starts to play another one of their great songs, I Used to Love Her, It's All Over Now. Again, you should check out the music, and I'll put links to all this afterwards on the show page, but you can buy a soundtrack of all the music, or you can certainly easily find the music that's played throughout the 36 episodes. So way too many to list here, but just dozens and dozens of great songs performed by local musicians. Davis McElhary's sometimes love interest, as I mentioned, is Jeanette Desitel. She's a chef. In the show, she's played by Kim Dickens. And Jeanette's basically trying to keep her restaurant afloat after the storm while also trying to get her home repaired, which, like almost everyone, it was severely damaged. I'm biased having grown up in a New Orleans restaurant that was destroyed in Katrina, but I really like this character. She's patterned after Susan Spicer, who's one of the top chefs in New Orleans. Spicer is the chef and owner of Bayona, and more recently, Mondo, over in Lakeview. In the Treme series, we see Jeanette struggle to pay the bills, get the supplies she needs for a top-notch restaurant, and keep employees who are suddenly in huge demand. This was a real problem after the storm. Of course, almost everyone evacuated, and then some people didn't come back or didn't come back for a while, and restaurants were trying to open up as quickly as possible, and so the few people that were available in the service industry basically, for the first time or for a long time, had the opportunity to go and make more money maybe than they were making before. So what it meant for a lot of these restaurants is they were sort of fighting with each other over trying to get staffing. And that's one of the things we see here as she's trying to get her restaurant back up. We also see the depression and the struggle in very real terms. And one of the more poignant moments for me was an episode where we see Jeanette riding a streetcar with tears in her eyes. In these early scenes, though, we see her at the restaurant. She's talking with her partner in the kitchen, Jock, about the struggles. And at one point, Jock mentions running to Dornach's to buy crawfish. And Jeanette goes on a mini rant about frozen Chinese crawfish. It's scenes like this that the locals love. Certainly I do. And it's loaded with these little gifts, again, like Easter eggs. And let me explain the thing about the crawfish. The restaurant in the show is called Desitelles, but it was filmed at Patois, which is a very good and nice restaurant in uptown New Orleans. Dornach's is a small, locally owned grocery store. Frozen Chinese crawfish are cheaper than Louisiana crawfish, but they're reviled by local restaurateurs. Let me tell you a little side story. And Dad, if you listen, you're just going to have to put up with this. You've heard before, my family owned a place in Gentilly called Teddy's Grill. It was a little neighborhood place. And we had po' boys and seafood and plate lunches, so we'd have red beans and rice on Monday. A very typical kind of place you'd find in New Orleans. And we had Louisiana crawfish, and I don't remember all the details, but at one point my dad just sort of suggested or hinted that, you know, maybe we could get Chinese crawfish. I think I was a teenager at the time, and I just sort of lost my mind and said, look, I'm going to make a big deal about this. I'm going to pick at our restaurant. I'm going to tell everybody you can't have frozen Chinese crawfish in our restaurant. We never did, and I don't think he was really serious about it. He probably barred it up just to sort of get me wound up. But nonetheless, we never had frozen Chinese crawfish or any kind of Chinese crawfish. But that's a big deal. And so when Jeanette said that, it certainly hit home for me. But let's get back to Treme, I guess. In the first episode, these opening scenes go for several minutes before we get to the opening credits and the theme music. Let's talk about the theme music now. The title of the song that leads into the main part of each episode is called the Treme Song, but it actually predates a TV series. It was first released in 2003, and it was written and performed by John Boutte. Again, if you listen to the podcast regularly, you've heard me talk about John. He's got one of the most beautiful voices in a city full of musical talent. He grew up in the Treme, and the song talks about scenes and sounds from the neighborhood. It has that distinctive New Orleans driving beat. You hear it in Mardi Gras music and brass music and funk. It also, again, describes life in the Treme. I'm not going to try to sing it for you, but the first couple lines, hanging in the Treme, watching people sashay, past my steps, by my porch, in front of my door. Church bells are ringing, choirs are singing, while the preachers groan and the sisters moan in a blessed tone. Down in the Treme, just me and my baby, we're all going crazy while jamming and having fun. Now that I've frightened you, please feel free to pause the episode, open your favorite music app, and search for John Boutte and or the Treme song. It's a great song, and it captures the essence of Treme. As it's playing, we get the opening credits. And there's an interesting thing if you watch for it over the four seasons. The backdrop to the credits changes. So it highlights the things that were happening during that year, as well as the themes of that season of the show. In this first year, the opening credits show second line, like historical pictures of second lines. It shows Katrina, the water rushing in, and the aftermath. It also shows the X mark on the outside of a house. And the X indicates that a search and rescue team checked the house. Each quadrant of the X tells a portion of the findings of that team. So the top, or the north, it gives the date and sometimes the time. The bottom, the south, tells how many victims were found dead. The west identifies the rescue team, and the east side of the X lists any hazards that were in the home. Another thing, So right after Katrina, you would see X's on almost every house. And where the X was on the house, it gave some indication how much water there was and when the search was done. So around town, there were some that were on the rooftop, especially in Lakeview, where they had water sometimes into the second floor of homes. Those searches had to be done by boat. And think about that for a minute, right? A major American city, and the water was so bad and so high, rescue teams had to go around by boat to check everyone out and check the houses. Other times, you'd see an X just above a water line on the house. And today, all these years later, you can still see the X's sometimes on abandoned homes, but in other cases, people returned and they left the X as a reminder. And depending on where it is and how much sunlight that part of the house gets, some of those X's look like they were painted, you know, pretty recently. Others, you can see that they've faded over time. And in fact, there's still several in the neighborhood where I live today. I see one in particular every morning as I drive to the office. Also in those opening credits that first season, you see a couple in the middle of a room looking up at the mold. You see the water line. You see photos destroyed by the water. And they kind of became like psychedelic looking. You'd see them kind of stuck to the wall and then the water hit, particularly if they were older photos. And I guess it would just bleed the chemicals that had been used to make the photo. You also see a boil basket, so a crawfish basket, if you will. And I'm pretty sure it's under a barge in the Ninth Ward. So there was a barge that hit the in the Industrial Canal that hit the levee, hit the cement wall, and it ended up in the neighborhood, basically. And so you can see near the end of the credits in the first season episodes, you can see this boil basket, which would have been used to boil crawfish or crabs, and it's just sort of tucked underneath the barge. You also see right at the end there the FEMA trailers that people came to just despise. So FEMA bought all these white trailers. A lot of them had problems. They had formaldehyde and all sorts of things. But it was supposed to be a temporary home for people. For the first season, the opening credits were designed to show what had been lost, including the culture, the music, the people that we've discussed already. And that sequence, it has more than 80 pieces that were used, like from film, video, and still photographs. They were all from people who used to live in New Orleans, including family images from the hurricane. And the title card, Tremé, in the background of it, you can see like a molded, flood-damaged home as the backdrop. If you look closely, you'll get a sense of what it was like to come back to a home that had been destroyed by the water. You just look for everyday things in those credits under the mold. If you look carefully, I saw a thermostat on the wall, a light switch, electrical sockets, a clock hanging. And they give you clues as to the height of the water. Near the end of the opening credits, you see a picket fence with only the tops of the pickets above the water. And again, as I mentioned, this changes from season to season. So in the second season of Tremé, the opening credits evolve. They kind of show more contemporary video and some updated themes that are going to happen in the season, including public housing residents protesting, some crime scenes, and the beginning of the rebuilding of the city. Also, the title card for season two shows more mold growing over the logo. It still shows Katrina and the second line, but it now shows people gutting their houses. It shows a house that the sheetrock's been removed from the interior. It shows one of those FEMA trailers with Christmas lights on it. It shows some scenes from Mardi Gras that year. And the band that you see in purple and gold is the St. Augustine High School Band, also known as the March in 100. It shows protests. And in general, it just shows current pictures with signs of recovery and struggle, but with some upbeat moments, whereas like the first season, those credits were all pretty bad. You know, I mean, they had the second line, but after that, it started to show pictures of the destruction. Here you're starting to see a little bit of turn in the corner. By the third season of Tremé, the opening credits are starting to show the revival of the city and the rebuilding, as well as new events from 2007-2008, which is when that season takes place, including the killing of a New Orleans police officer, Nicola Cotton, and also a couple scandals. The title card again evolves, and this time in the third season, it shows being replastered over the mold of the previous season. So you're starting to see the mold go away. And it's set 25 months after the storm. So again, you see new sheetrock now in the credits. You see some paint being applied. You see Indian suits being made, Mardi Gras Indian suits. You also see a car that's been burned. And that's central to the theme that year, where they're talking about a real-life event. It's a little bit fictionalized, but a real-life event where a body is burned. and there's some insinuation that the police are involved in it. Also, again, I mentioned an officer was killed that year. You see some information about FEMA in the credits, but you also have people starting to cook. So you get good and bad. You have the cooking and the bringing back the traditions. You have the Skull and Bones gang, which these are gangs that wake up early on Mardi Gras morning and they go and knock on homes to sort of wake up everybody and get everyone ready for the celebration of Mardi Gras. And then you also see an image of former Mayor Ray Nagin testifying. Nagin ultimately went to prison for corruption. So you start to see some of that that being shown in the show. And then you get to the fourth season. Remember I said there were four seasons of Treme, a total of 36 episodes. The fourth season was shortened. It was only 5 episodes. But when you look at the opening credits for the fourth season, you definitely see recovery. You see a lot of imagery of Barack Obama being elected as president. You get more footage of sort of joyous images of New Orleans and occasions. So what I understand is the person that put it together did the fourth season credits as sort of a thank you to the city. And when you see the title card, the final title card, all of a sudden it's on a newly painted white plastered wall. And you actually see one of the actors in the show, Clark Peters. He's like hand brushing the final strokes on it. So the first episode in that series, in the fourth season, is called Yes, We Can. And it's set 38 months afterwards. So after Katrina. So you see voting, you see political signs. You can see actually a sign for Mary Landrieu, who was running for re-election in the Senate that year. And interestingly, Mary Landrieu's dad, Moon Landrieu, was a mayor in New Orleans in the 1970s. And Mary Landrieu's brother, is Mitch Landrieu, is the mayor right now in 2016 in New Orleans. You also see in the credits, you see the Cajun Mardi Gras. You see coconuts from the Mardi Gras Parade Zulu. You see the Muses Parade, who throws decorated women's high-heeled shoes. You also see a Hubig's Pie, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And near the end, you see a man pushing a tamale cart. And then, like I mentioned, Clark Peters, he's painting the Treme sign. So again, by that fourth season, you're starting to see real signs of recovery and joy mixed in with some things that are a little bit tough. But it's a much more positive set of images, certainly, than the first year and the even an episode or in year two. In each episode, as I mentioned, the Treme song is playing as these credits roll. And John Boutte, again, he grew up in the Treme. So the song, I think, it describes the neighborhood and the cultural significance all in one. And the fact that the show's creators relied on a local musician, it adds credibility, of course, but it also points to the huge popularity the show had with New Orleanians, at least at first. You know, we love our music and our traditions, and we love to see them shared. Additionally, in just those first few minutes, you start to see a couple of themes. The local musicians and the music. By just 7 minutes in, you've already been introduced to the Rebirth Brass Band and to John Boutte. And that parade of local musicians, the music and actors, again, it's a hallmark, and that continues throughout all four seasons. So that was one of the things that was really great about Treme. You could constantly see musicians that you either knew or that you had been and seen their work, that you were fans of, and it was really great to see that shared with the world, and certainly helped a lot of those musicians get a bigger audience than they had before Treme. It also created a lot of jobs, so there was a whole infrastructure that was built up. At the time, they were filming not only Treme, but New Orleans was sort of known as Hollywood South. It sort of died down a little bit, but there were a lot of tax credits being offered, and as a result, this movie industry sprang up. So you had well-known actors come to town to work, and that had always been the case, but you had lots of local people who suddenly had opportunities, and then the infrastructure around the movie business and the television business. So that was really great. And again, so you had lots of people and lots of money coming in to support the economy while Treme was being made, and certainly the city and the people here appreciated that. So now I want to kind of just move on and talk a little bit about some of the characters. We mentioned Antoine Baptiste, but I want to get you familiar with the main characters that come and go throughout the four seasons. Excuse me, I need to take a drink there. The first person I want to talk about is John Goodman, who plays a Tulane professor named Creighton Burnett. Creighton's working on a book about the Great Mississippi Flood in 1927. So if you don't know, in 1927 there was a flood here, and the levees were dynamited downriver from New Orleans in an effort to save New Orleans. So John Goodman's character is playing this Tulane professor who's writing a book. He lives in uptown New Orleans, and he's based in real life on a blogger named Ashley Morris. Morris had been very critical about the coverage, the media coverage of New Orleans, and he had also written a blog, interestingly, about The Wire. So David Simon was familiar with him. Morris died of a heart attack in 2008, but Simon actually used some of his writings as dialogue for Creighton in this series. Of particular note is one article that Morris wrote, titled, and I'll try to clean this up, F-U, you effin' F's. So you probably don't need to use too much imagination, right? And a lot of that article, again, there's a scene early on where John Goodman is talking to a television reporter from the BBC right up against the Mississippi River. And I'll read just a bit. He says, he's asked about the storm, and he says, natural disaster. What hit the Gulf Coast was a natural disaster. The flooding in New Orleans was a man-made catastrophe, a federal F-up of epic proportions and decades in the making. And then it sort of goes on and downhill from there. It's interesting that John Goodman's also a longtime resident of New Orleans. And he also, while Tremé was pretty critically acclaimed and a great representation in many aspects of New Orleans, he also played a role in one of the cheesiest New Orleans films ever, The Big Easy. I still enjoy it, but it is campy as can be. And in fact, we're going to talk about that movie in a future episode. We're going to do a whole episode about movies and maybe television shows that were filmed in New Orleans. In any event, John Goodman's character in Tremé is important because it reflects a perspective shared by most locals after the storm. The sense that others didn't care or understand the importance of New Orleans. And the belief that this was a natural disaster. It wasn't. Katrina was a disaster in the sense that obviously it was a big hurricane that came. But the real issue in New Orleans was the flooding when the levees failed. And the levees failed because of design flaws. So, you know, as a New Orleanian, you just got tired of hearing about how this was a natural disaster. It wasn't. It was a man-made disaster that was made worse by the hurricane. Creighton also shows clear signs of being on edge, not only the rant he goes off on, but as we learn throughout the episodes, probably suffering from depression. And keep in mind, this character's family made out well by most standards after the storm. They probably didn't get much water damage. I think his wife in the show mentions at some point that they had a little bit of roof damage. But the stress and the depression, and in many cases the PTSD, was sort of this shared experience throughout New Orleans. At one time they said probably 75%, I think was the figure I heard, of the residents in New Orleans who had been here at Katrina or right after were suffering from depression. And it certainly seemed like everybody you talked to was having a really hard time, whether they had lost everything or they hadn't lost anything, because then there was sort of this survivor's guilt kind of thing where people just felt so bad that they hadn't experienced as much loss as their neighbor. So as a New Orleanian, when Goodman's character goes on a rant while talking to that British reporter, I was kind of cheering inside, and I suspect that most New Orleanians related to that. Creighton and Davis McAlary provide a lot of context, by the way, a lot of commentary and a lot of background. So if you're watching the show and there's something going on you're not familiar with, listen to those two. Usually one of them will clue you in. In the first episode, in this introduction to Creighton, we start to get some of the politics and the national discussion that was going on at the time. And Creighton will grow increasingly frustrated with the national discourse as the show progresses. And again, I think in reading a lot of interviews with David Simon in particular, I think that that's part of what he was trying to get at with the show, about this happens all the time, right? It didn't just happen with Katrina. It happens anytime there's a big disaster where there starts to be this discussion and you have all this opinion from outside of the actual place that's having to deal with the disaster. I think I mentioned early on that one thing about Tremé is it has this very large cast, this ensemble cast, right? And I want to make sure that you at least get exposed, if you haven't seen the show, to the different, at least most of the big recurring players in the show. So remember we talked about Antoine Baptiste, the trombone player, right? In the series, Antoine's girlfriend and the father of his youngest son is named Desiree. She's played by Phyllis Montana LeBlanc, and she might be my favorite person on the show, with apologies to my friend Paul Sanchez, who makes several appearances. In real life, Phyllis is a New Orleanian whose home was destroyed in the storm. She was interviewed in Spike Lee's When the Levees Broke, and she just like went off. There's no other way to put it. If you watch the Spike Lee documentary, you'll remember Phyllis. on the television show Treme, she's constantly trying to keep Antoine on the straight and narrow, pushing him to see and talk with his kids, to get home on time, make some steady money, and certainly not wander. Her character has the attitude and mannerisms New Orleanians know all too well. She makes me smile, but her character, like many of the others, displays the challenges that people are dealing with, the stress. She's continued to act since Treme, and she's written a book called Not Just the Levees Broke. I'll put a link to it over in the show notes at beyondbourbonst.com/26. I haven't read it yet, but I will, and I might even see if we can get her on the podcast at some point. Earlier, we mentioned Antoine's ex-wife, LaDonna. LaDonna's brother went missing during the storm after being arrested. She enlists the help of an attorney, Tony Burnett. Tony is Creighton's wife, and she's portrayed by Melissa Leo, who worked with Simon and Overmeyer on Homicide, Life on the Street. Leo also won an Oscar in 2010 for Best Supporting Actress in the movie The Fighter. In Treme, she's passionate about challenging the New Orleans Police Department and the sheriff over alleged civil rights offenses. It does highlight one of the many challenges of the storm. What do you do with the inmates? They were sent to various prisons throughout Louisiana, and it was widely accepted that there were periods where there wasn't full accountability. In Treme, as Tony is researching Damo, she talks to a reporter at the local paper, the Times-Picayune. That institution essentially doesn't exist anymore. They have an online version, but it's nowhere near the institution that the Times-Picayune was. But during the storm, it was a terrific newspaper, and ultimately, they won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting and their coverage of the storm and the after effects. Nonetheless, their headquarters was located very close to the New Orleans Parish Prison, which is known locally as OPP. In one scene, they talk about seeing prisoners on the I-10 overpass. This particular overpass, also known as the Broad Street Flyover, is literally outside the windows of the now-shuttered newspaper office. I travel across it every morning, actually, and I think about that scene from the series nearly every day. Incidentally, I read an interesting take from a local criminal defense lawyer about the presentation of police and the handling of inmates as all that's portrayed in the show. And I'll post it in the show notes, but basically he argued that while there are problems, and there were problems, maybe a lot of problems, that most of the police officers he's dealt with are good, respectable people trying to do their jobs. And even during the storm, he had some experience, particularly with a group known as the Danziger 7, which I'll talk about in a minute. And he felt like police in general in New Orleans do and did a good job. And that's certainly been my experience, but it doesn't mean that there aren't problems. In fact, problems within the NOPD are well known to New Orleanians. During the storm, there was a major incident, which is a storyline in the series. I just mentioned it. It's referred to as the Danziger Bridge shootings. And you'll hear the police officers involved referred to as the Danziger 7. At the same time, as I mentioned, there's lots of good, honest police officers on the force. It's not to say that there isn't a history of serious problems. There are, and it continues to be today. And after the storm, there were lots of stories, not just about the NOPD, but law enforcement in surrounding areas and some of the problems immediately as the storm was hitting in afterwards. I should add, on a side note, at the same time, there were lots of stories of people just doing heroic things to help the citizens in New Orleans. In any event, Tony's character, again, Tony is Creighton's wife. Tony's character is based on Mary Howell, who's a veteran civil rights lawyer here in New Orleans. She spent years working to stop the confrontations and abuse of Mardi Gras Indians by police officers. Creighton and Tony in the show have a teenage daughter named Sophia, who's played by India Enenga. I didn't think too much about the character when the show first aired. But as the father of two young girls, I now see it in a different light. Katrina affected everyone from New Orleans, and it affected an entire generation of kids who lived through it. Many of them had to deal with the loss of their homes, and even worse, family members. Most kids had to go to school in Baton Rouge or even someplace further away. And in many cases, the need to put kids in school was a driving factor in families not coming back quickly or even at all. You know, they got settled in other places. The kids got used to the community, got used to the school. It was really hard to try to bring them back or think about bringing them back when New Orleans was in such a state of disrepair. Through Sophia's character, we see an interesting lens. She's from a fairly privileged family. They live uptown on Octavia Street. That area didn't get a ton of water, and while some people suffered damage to their homes, As a whole, they didn't get hit like other parts of the city. Yet, through Sophia, you see the depression, the acting out, and the struggle to digest what's happened. For anyone with kids, you'll appreciate the perspective. It's also interesting to watch her character develop and grow over the four seasons. As with kids, you know, as with the whole generation of kids, Katrina kids, they used to call them, 4 years is a long time in the life of a child. Next person I want to talk about is Albert, Big Chief Lambro. He's played by Clark Peters, who I mentioned earlier. And Albert's a Mardi Gras Indian chief whose home was devastated, like so many others. He comes back, he moves into the neighborhood bar because he figures he can clean it out easier than he can clean out his house. And he immediately starts preparing for Mardi Gras and St. Joseph's Night. Meanwhile, he tries to get his gang back together. He has two children, a daughter and a son. The daughter is named Davina, and she now lives in Houston. So they evacuated to Houston. She's living there, and she wants her dad to come back to Houston and stay there. At the same time, he's got a son, Delmond, who's a successful jazz trumpeter playing and living in New York City. Delmond is played by actor Rob Brown, and he's torn between living his successful New York life and the pull of his dad and the traditions of New Orleans and masking Indian. By the second season, we really see it as Delmond's trying to intermingle the two aspects of his life. His character is at least influenced, if not patterned, after Christian Scott, who's a successful trumpeter who lives in New York but grew up in New Orleans. Scott's grandfather is Donald Harrison Sr., who founded the Guardians of the Flame Indian tribe. Donald Harrison Jr. took over after his father and provided input into the creation of the Big Chief character in Treme. Big Chief Lambro is really a central character in the show. He represents a struggle of many New Orleanians and African-American New Orleanians in particular. Throughout the series, he works hard to rebuild his version of New Orleans, and you can see he's trying to ensure that the Mardi Gras Indian tradition continues. Through the Big Chief, you get an excellent introduction to the world of Mardi Gras Indian gangs, too. We witness the dedication and the skill that goes into crafting a suit that's worn on Mardi Gras Day and on St. Joseph's Day at night. You also get to see the common struggle after the storm within families. You know, in this case, you got the daughter, Davina, who wants to move on, and she wants her dad to come to Houston where things are better and they can have a nice life. And you see Delmond kind of stuck somewhere in between. You can really see he's got this nice, successful life in New York City, but he feels this pull. He's trying to take care of his dad. He's trying to move on with his life. And so you really see this dilemma that I think in various ways played out in lots and lots of families. A couple more central characters I want to introduce you to, Annie and Sonny. Annie and Sonny are street musicians who are also romantically involved. Annie is the more talented musician, as we see during the show's progression. And Sonny is a new Orleanian. He only moved in the show to the Crescent City just months before the storm. However, like many New Orleanians, new and old, he quickly adopts our love of tradition and the sort of sometimes wearisome feeling about tourists and their pursuit of the cliched version of New Orleans. One example is he kind of mocks someone who requests that they play When the Saints Go Marching In. And on the one hand, we love this song in New Orleans, especially when it's associated with the New Orleans Saints. On the other hand, we have, you know, a quite rich musical culture and history that goes way past that song. So you see Sonny acting out about that. And it's kind of clever because he's only been a New Orleanian for a little while, but he's already adopted that attitude that most of us have here. Sonny also has a drug problem, which becomes problematic not only for his relationship with Annie, but also his musical career. And this character is one you probably won't like in the first season. I certainly didn't. He's just not that likable, really. But if you watch the entire four seasons, you see a pretty remarkable change in Sonny. I've been trying hard in this episode not to spoil the series, but Sonny's character in many ways mirrors the overall story over the four seasons. At the beginning, he's down and out, again, not that likable, and by the end, you see a real change, sort of this renewal and kind of a bright future. Annie is a classically trained violinist who busks on the street with Sonny. Her character takes on a more expansive role as the series moves forward. Along the way, she becomes friends with another musician, Harley Watt, who becomes kind of a mentor. Harley is played by the real-life Steve Earle, which, if you know a Steve Earle, you know how great a musician he is. Earle wrote several songs for Treme, in fact. Perhaps my favorite is This City, which you can hear during the closing credits of the first season's final episode. Earl is also one of the many actors who was on The Wire, again, Simon and Overmeyer's HBO series that was set in Baltimore. I don't want to give it all away, but I'll just say that it's an interesting fact that the writer, George Pelicanos, was also involved in both series. When you figure out the significance, tag me on Twitter at BeyondBourbonST or send me an email at mark@beyondbourbonst.com. These are the main characters you meet in the first season. As the show progresses into future seasons, you come across Nelson Hidalgo. Nelson arrives from Texas looking to make money off the disaster. He hooks up with several influential rainmakers in the city, notably New Orleans City Councilman Oliver Thomas. In real life, Thomas would go to prison for deals he made after the storm, and then, in sort of an only in New Orleans kind of thing, he became an actor after getting released. We also meet a policeman, Terry Colson, who tries to help Tony uncover the corruption in law enforcement. And we meet a reporter who's looking into the corruption in the Danziger case and an unsolved murder. That reporter's name is L.P. Everett in the show. There's many more characters that come and go over the 36 episodes, but with the list I've provided, you'll have a good start if you decide to watch. I kind of want to shift now and talk about the authenticity of the series because I get asked about it a lot. In an interview after the first season, Davis Rogan said the bar for accurate portrayals in New Orleans, based on past television shows and movies, is about 25%. He thought Treme was consistently in the 85 to 95% range. And, you know, that sounds about right to me, and it indicates how hard the creators, the writers, the actors, and the consultants worked at it. David Simon actually wrote an open letter to the people in New Orleans that was published in the Times-Picayune just before the first episode aired. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it was really kind of a love letter of sorts. He talked about the idea of historical fiction, and he said right up front, look, we made a lot of this stuff up, but we tried to do it in a way that was an accurate portrayal of New Orleans. He also wrote about how the people in New Orleans and their opinion of the show were really the only thing he cared about as he tried to make decisions and tried to present the show. In an interview, he talked about Herman Melville, actually, and how the characters in Moby Dick weren't real, but there was an actual accident involving a Boston whaler that became an inspiration for the story. And he likened that to his approach with Treme. They certainly tried hard. The series is full of things, people, and references that make New Orleanians smile. In one early episode, for instance, Jeanette runs out of desserts, and she offers Creighton a Hubig's pie from her purse. Now, Hubig's pies were these deep-fried fruit pies crusted with sugar. And if you're thinking that's gross, you're just wrong. If you said, wow, that sounds great, then you're my kind of people, let me tell you. We loved Hubig's so much, we served them in place of a groom's cake at our wedding. They made special wrappers with our name and the date on them. And heck, we even dressed our kids as Hubig pies from Mardi Gras one year. One lemon and one apple, because we're a house divided, but I digress. During the show, the appearance of the Hubig's pies caused a mini uproar. You know, in New Orleans, we get like really worked up about small things. So the uproar was that the Hubig's pies weren't actually available during the time that was portrayed in the show. It was like a month or two off, but they weren't available. Simon even mentioned it in his love letter, kind of with a wink and a nod. He said the ones on the show were magic Hubig's pies, so that's how they were able to go back in time, and she was able to offer them to Creighton. But there were so many more references. Tony and Sophia visit Angelo Bricata's ice cream parlor. Bricata's had just celebrated their 100th anniversary, like just a couple days before the storm hit. And you can visit them today on Carrollton Avenue. To get there, actually, if you're downtown, you take the Red Canal Street streetcar towards City Park. When LaDonna, here's another example, when LaDonna meets Tony to talk about Damo, they meet for lunch at Little Dizzy's in the Treme. Little Dizzy's is known for fried chicken, and you should stop by when you're in New Orleans. It's packed, though, so don't go right at lunch. You need to kind of go, you know, well before lunchtime, before noon, or maybe a little bit afterwards. Here's some other places where you can go to check out things that were actually shown in the television series. I mentioned this several times, I think, but Jeanette Desitel's restaurant scenes, they were filmed at a real-life restaurant, Patois, in uptown New Orleans. Again, I just mentioned Angelo Bricado's. You can listen to WWOZ-FM or online. That's a place where Davis works in the show. And listening to WWOZ is an especially good choice during Mardi Gras and during Jazz Fest. But you can never go wrong if you need a New Orleans fix. And again, you can listen to it online all year long now. That wasn't available back then. I mentioned Little Dizzy's. Another one is Vaughn's in the Bywater. Throughout the series, you see Kermit Ruffins in particular playing at Vaughn's. And he doesn't play there anymore. He used to have a Thursday night gig there for years and years. But always good music, good place to go. You can also go to the Spotted Cat on Frenchman or DBA. Great places for jazz. Both places that show up periodically in the series. You can also, several times, CC's Community Coffee was featured in the show. So there was a scene when Tony brings coffee, I think, to meet LaDonna, and she's got, it's CC's Community Coffee. So that's a great coffee, plenty of shops all around town. They show Kermit Ruffin's barbecuing at one point, and that's true. He's often known to bring this big, like, pull-behind-the-truck kind of barbecue rig, and he'll perform, and then he'll also cook and offer his barbecue. I've never had it, but I hear it's actually pretty good. You can go listen to the band Galactic, which makes an appearance in a couple of shows. You can also, one of the things you can do if you're interested in sort of experiencing some of what happened or what was seen in Treme, is you can take the Canal Street Ferry over to Algiers Point. And I won't give it all away, but that particular ride on the ferry over to Algiers, it plays a pivotal role in the development of Creighton, of John Goodman's character, Creighton. Then there's also the music, and we've talked about that a good bit. Kermit Ruffins, John Boutte, Glenn David Andrews, Paul Sanchez, Rebirth Brass Band, Trombone Shorty, Alan Toussaint, Irma Thomas. The list just goes on and on. There are dozens of musicians from New Orleans who made appearances or their music was featured in Treme. And I realized while I was preparing for the episode that many of the places, the music, the traditions, the food that are mentioned in Treme are things we've been covering over the last year on the podcast. And that makes me really happy because the whole reason I do this show is to share New Orleans with you. And I guess what I'm saying is if you go do and visit and see and eat and do all the things we've been talking about in the show, you're going to experience the New Orleans that you see in Treme. I also want to mention, people have asked my perspective, so what'd you think about the show? I thought the first season was spot on. It hit the emotions, the devastation, the outside perspectives. I love seeing real people in the show. We're clearly seeing who the characters were representing. You know, it was overplayed in parts, but that's fine. It's still show business and entertainment. By the middle of the second season, or maybe the early part of the third, it was starting to lose me a little bit. And as I think about it, it rebounded at the next season, but it was really time for it to end. I think for New Orleans, it was time for it to end. The recovery is far longer, far more complex, and in some ways, you know, not that exciting. Think of it like the movie about the kid over many years. I can't remember the name of it. Or even about your own child's life. You know, the beginning is, and I'm gonna get emails on this, I know. But the beginning is super exciting. And there's like these terrifically interesting moments. But then when you look back over a decade or a lifetime, most people have fascinating stories if you're willing to dig into them. But if you tried to give play-by-play continuously, I don't know how many people's lives can hold that much interest. And that's kind of, maybe not the best example, but that's kind of how I felt about Treme. It was really great. It was really exciting. It was so much fun to see people that we knew and see things that we recognize. But over time, it just got a little bit hard to watch because it's hard to watch the day-to-day struggles of the city, you know, represented on TV. And during the time that the series aired, we were still in it, in the middle of it. It just got hard to watch at times. Overall, though, I think the HBO series is definitely worth watching. At a minimum, watch the first season. It'll give you a broad sense of what it was like and how it brought to the surface these underlying tensions locally and nationally. Again, it kind of dragged on once things got going, but truthfully, so did the recovery. I'd almost like to see Simon revisit it to show where the characters in the city are and where the city is now. If you're a fan of New Orleans, which by virtue of listening to the podcast, you are, you'll love the glimpse into the city, the music, the imagery, even the difficulty in the heartbreak that's really always been a part of the Crescent City. I think with that, we're going to call it a wrap. I feel like I threw a lot at you, and yet I only scratched the surface. I'll put the links to the interviews I mentioned on the show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com/26, and I'll also include links to several books, including Tom Piazza's Why New Orleans Matters. Thanks so much for listening, y'all. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And do me a favor, if you're enjoying the show, please find just one other person who might also like it and share it with them. Just a reminder about that service. I started offering the service where I'll provide you a customized list of where to stay, what to do, eat, and see. It includes a 20-minute discussion with me to get a sense of your preferences, when you're going to visit, your price points, all that sort of stuff. If you're interested, send me an email. My address is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. As always, new episodes of the podcast are available every other Wednesday. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.